This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an updated perspective on the growing authoritarianism under the Trump administration.
Prominent professor and author of many books, Henry Giroux compares Trump's early moves to those of fascists of the past. Next, we hear from a journalist and author who describes the biased way the corporate media in America is covering the Trump administration and the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza. Norman Solomon, author of War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, also critiques Trump's attacks on America's colleges and universities under the pretext that they have failed to adequately address anti-Semitism on their campuses.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We're living in a time of profound changes in the institutions that previously governed our society. 100 years ago, V.I. Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, observed that sometimes nothing changes for decades, and at other times, decades-long changes occur within several days. This is what's happening now in America, as the old institutions, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the universities, the media, the government, including Congress, governmental agencies, the elite law firms, educational institutions, and most recently, long-standing tariff policies are being reconfigured as instruments of an authoritarian rule. Over 800 billionaires form the upper crust in America. Three people alone own as much as the entire bottom half of the population. Democracy, the rule of the people, however aspirational, no longer prevails. We have become an oligarchy, a majority of our people ruled by a relative handful. Our institutions have rapidly changed to reflect this new reality. We're governed by an amoral man whose only interest is in power and money, which is another form of power. We speak today about this situation and what we can do to resist it with our returning guest, Professor Henry Giroux. He's the author of many books and articles, including most recently a piece in Counterpunch titled Abducting Bodies, Silencing Dissent, Mahmoud Khalil, and the Rise of State Terrorism. Henry Giroux, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, hi. Yes, it's certainly an honor to be on the program. Thanks so much for inviting me back.
Glad to have you, Henry. Henry, last month, Mahmoud Khalil, a leader of the student protests against the Israeli-American genocide in Gaza, and a recent graduate student in international affairs at Columbia University, was abducted by ICE. This was done with the complicity of his own university. He was abducted from his New York City apartment, snatched in his hallway by unidentified masked men, put into a black car, and driven to the airport, where he was flown to a detention facility in rural Louisiana. Khalil was a legal resident in the United States, possessing a green card and entitled to the rights and privileges with respect to free speech and association as an American citizen. The next week, Rumeysa Ozturk, a graduate student at Tufts University, who had written an article in the newspaper critical of the Gaza genocide, was also picked up by ICE, and she was also taken to a detention facility in Louisiana. What do these abductions portend, and why do you call them state terror?
Well, I call them state terrorism because I think what's happening here is that they signal really the full emergence of fascism in the United States. These are not really isolated acts, but part of a broader strategy to criminalize dissent, especially among immigrant communities and student activists. I mean, these are not legal deportations, but extrajudicial disappearances meant to terrorize and silence. And when I say these are acts of state terror, I mean, what we have here is we have a government that's weaponizing the state apparatus. ICE, Homeland Security, masked agents, and what do? They disappear individuals without due process. If that isn't state terrorism, I don't know what else we can call it. And it's not unlike the architecture of what I would call terror that we've seen in the past. I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, much like the Gestapo These agencies abduct, they silence, they erase, often invoking in many ways vague national security pretexts like support for terrorism or anybody who dissents is apparently is anti-Semitic. This is all very clear. This is what Ruth Wilson Gilmore once called organized abandonment and organized violence. And it's very central to what I call the rise of the Castro state, which is the punishing state, which in many ways has taken a new and more insidious turn under the Trump administration.
Well, Henry, yeah, and following up on that, it would appear, in fact, that the Trump administration, as I think you're suggesting, is operating from the same playbook that, Hitler used in Germany, for goodness sake. Frankfurt University, like Columbia, was an elite institution in that country. Hitler's representative appeared on the campus one day, fired all the Jewish professors, kicked the Jews out that were students, and won the cooperation of university professors who apparently cared more about funding their own research than protecting the students and protecting the autonomy of the university. What has happened in the governance of Columbia University that allows this to happen, do you think?
Well, I think we need to understand something about what's happened to higher education in general, particularly since the 1980s. I mean, at one point, higher education in universities and colleges had a sense of a mission. I mean, in a sense, they were there to equip students with the skills and the knowledge they needed to not only be able to get great jobs, but also to be active citizens, to be critical, to be informed. And increasingly, what they've become are nothing more than ideological adjuncts of the corporate state. They've been corporatized. Once bastions of critical inquiry, now they often act as compliant arms of the surveillance state, of corporations. Billionaires now are defining what should be done in universities, how students should be treated, who should get jobs, who should be rewarded. And in the case of Trump, it's even worse. I mean, this is nothing more than authoritarian forms of blackmail, you know, sort of threatening universities to succumb to acts of surveillance, to rethinking how their curricula performs, to taking over entire departments and claiming that if they don't, they won't get their funding. Well, if universities believe that all that matters are profits and funding, then it certainly isn't going to be surprising to see them become compliant rather than enable and defend the principles of democracy, just be indifferent to them, because democracy is not part of what they do anymore. Preparing students for democracy is not part of what they do anymore.
Henry, I wanted to ask you about Jason Stanley. Stanley was a prominent Yale professor and an expert on fascism. He's recently quit his job at Yale. He took a position in Canada at a university in Ontario. Your thoughts about what happened to him, please.
Stanley, who I know, is a friend. I think his departure is a canary in the coal mine. I mean, when a leading scholar on fascism leaves one of the world's top institutions citing authoritarianism as the reason, I think we need to listen. His move is a form of intellectual and political exile. He's an exile. He's not just taking another job, and he's echoing the flight of Jewish scholars from Nazi Germany in the 1930s. And I think that Stanley's critique is part of a broader institutional failure of what he calls the failure of elites. Though I don't particularly like that term, but I understand what he's saying. I think that universities, the media, law firms have not merely remained silent, but have actively cooperated in the erosion of democratic norms. And his departure is both an indictment and a warning. If even elite so-called scholars can no longer feel safe or heard in U.S. institutions, I think it's fair to say that democracy is, for the most part, almost dead.
Well, Henry, indeed, you wrote in your Counterpunch article that Mahmoud Khalil's case is about the fate of democracy itself. And then, of course, Trump had said that he wants to be dictator for a day. He said that he who saves the country does not violate the law, et cetera, et cetera. And you wrote that what we now have in the USA is really, and I quote, authoritarianism with fascist overtones, close quote. Why do you believe that? Talk to us more about that.
You know, as soon as you label dissent as an act of terrorism, you're creating a language of violence that then translates into policy, which becomes a practice of violence. And the practice of violence, when it's legitimated by that kind of malignant lawlessness parading as legality, ends up in a particular place, as we know from history. It ends up in crushing dissent. It ends up in crushing ideas. It ends up in crushing bodies. And it finally ends up in concentration camps. and ends up in torture chambers. So I think we need to be very, very concerned about what happens when basic rights are not just simply abused, but you have somebody like Tom Horman who actually argues that he doesn't care whether he's breaking the law or not. He doesn't care what the left lunatics claim about the injustices that are being committed. I mean, when all of a sudden rights disappear, people disappear. When people disappear, justice disappears. When justice disappears, violence and state terrorism takes its place.
Henry, I wanted to ask you about a person who's a particularly admirable person for both me and Jim and you, Primo Levi. Can you tell our audience who Primo Levi was, and please comment on his understanding when he wrote that every age has its own fascism, and we can see this warning signs wherever concentration of power denied citizens the possibility of the means of exercising and acting on their own free will?
Thanks for the question. I particularly like this question because, first of all, let me answer it very specifically. Primo Levi was an Auschwitz survivor and a brilliant moral philosopher who wanted to warn the world the experience that he underwent in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany, under the Nazis in Germany, was not something that should simply be seen as an historical relic. It isn't simply to be interned in history. That fascism is not confined to the past. It's a recurring threat that reemerges whenever power becomes concentrated and dissent is suppressed. And I think there are many people now writing claiming that fascism is outdated, we don't need to refer to it, it's inappropriate, we don't have concentration camps. I really think this is nonsense. I think that what we need to understand and what's painfully clear are what the hallmarks of fascism are and how certain fascist passions become mobilized and take on different forms: censorship, surveillance, scapegoating, terror, abductions, state violence, and how these are growing in the U.S. under Trump. And when we look and we ask ourselves, okay, what does this have to do with the past? Well, when ICE can abduct green card holders for writing op-eds, no less, and when protest is equated with terrorism, it seems to me that Levy's warning is no longer theoretical. It's unfolding before our eyes.
Well, I suspect that you would certainly agree that stripping any group of their humanity is, well, the beginning of their full victimization. Now, what groups has Trump and his movement done that to already, do you believe?
Well, I think there's something to understand here. I think if you really want to understand the nature of American fascism, you have to understand it in its totality. That the crisis that we're dealing with can only be grasped, if I may put it this way, as a crisis of the totality, meaning that we have three interrelated, it seems to me, wars going on in the United States. One is a war against immigrants. One is a war against academics. And one is a war against any form of censorship. A war against any form of critical opposition. And I think in that sense, you know, we can see that what is going on here is three forms of cleansing, if I can use that term. There is a cleansing of academia itself, of the public good. Any institution that suggests that government has a social responsibility is under attack. We see that with the attack on federal workers, of course, right? The other attack is the attack, basically, it's a war on immigrants. It's a war, it's a racial war. This is a form of racial cleansing. It's a war that says that anybody who is not white, who is then a white Christian nationalist, no longer deserves the category of citizenship and will be punished for that in ways that we've already talked about. And the third war is a war on thought itself, on critical thought itself. This is the war that's manifesting on academia and any other institution that's capable of a kind of critical impulse, law firms, any institution, higher education, public education, journalists, media, critical media commentators. All of these people, all of those groups are under siege because they all represent important guardrails in the defense of democracy. And when you have a government that believes that the only thing that matters is illiberal democracy, then you can begin to understand the interrelated nature of these attacks. This is what fascism looks like. There's no room for democracy to breathe in fascism. There's no room for its exponents, to breathe, and there's no room for the institutions that hold power accountable to breathe.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. We're speaking with Henry Giroux. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. Henry, you wrote that Trump has put us into a state of perpetual turmoil designed to secure control at any cost. Is it working?
Oh, let me try to answer this. It's a wonderful question. I need to answer this in a way that doesn't simplify it. I think, look, we have to understand that for Trump, theater has to work on steroids. He's a believer in what I would call the politics of the spectacular, right? So he believes that perpetual turmoil is really a constant element to throw people off. Chaos, you know, every day a new assault, every day, a new element to demoralize the public and the media so they can't keep up. This is basically a form of depoliticization. And it trades in trauma, it trades in fear, and it trades in large scale events that essentially uproot established legal and political and economic and social conventions. But saying that, I think it's backfired. I think that all of a sudden what we're seeing is a backlash unlike anything that we have seen maybe in a long time since the Vietnam War. Because all of a sudden, the attacks that the Trump administration is producing, touching people in their lives and in their experiences in ways that are not abstract. You want to take away people's Social Security? Well, you better deal with what that means. People understand what that means, even the people who voted for Trump. You want to close down healthcare? You want to eliminate the possibility of people being able to even get a vaccine? Well, that's too close to home to be relegated to high theory. And I think that what Trump has done, he's denormalized a form of fascism that seems to exist as a logic that seems unrelated to people's lives except from the theoretical exponents who, of course, are against it. So I think this the contradiction here is enormous. The shock doctrine is falling apart, as Naomi Klein has once argued. It's falling apart. And while it's expected to create crisis to divert resistance, it's just the opposite is now happening. It's creating a crisis that out of mobilizing resistance. I mean, when 50,000 people show up in a particular city like Las Vegas, 40,000 people protesting, let's be honest, something is going on here in the form of mass demonstrations that are not simply short-lived. There's a longing among all of these people to change the kind of power relations and ideologies that are putting their lives at the level of everyday life at risk.
Well, you know, Henry, following up on that, in fact, you're quite right. I mean, my goodness, on April 5th, it's estimated that anywhere between 4 and 5 million people were in the streets protesting Trump. Oh, there had been some protests certainly against Trump over the last several months before that, but nothing on the scale that we saw on April the 5th. Well, I grew up in Michigan, spent the majority of my life there, and yet I heard of towns in Michigan holding demonstrations against Trump on April 5th, the towns of which I had never actually heard of. And I discovered they were small towns and seemed like half the population was on the streets protesting Trump. Where would you like to see things go from here? Simply continue, expand? I mean, what are all the things we have to do if we're going to actually fight this growing fascism of Trump, the authoritarianism and such?
Well, I think that one of the things that has to happen here is that these movements have to be brought together to debate and decide how to fight these attacks. It's going to require broad democratic campaigns that mobilize working class people, unions, school teachers, academics, all across the country. And it's essential that unions, especially academic workers unions, immigrant rights people, use their power to take a stand, the power of their labor. Now, and this is important, we not only need these people to organize collectively under the banner of fighting fascism and fighting for democracy. In other words, we need a language of critique and a language of possibility in which that narrative can bring people together in ways in which they can use the power of their label to disrupt businesses at universities. Economically, we need direct action and we need mass strikes. You need to shut the system down where it hurts. Now think about this. Trump imposes all these trade tariffs, And all of a sudden, the billionaires have off. They get together, and they force Trump to reverse his policy, if only temporarily. Think about it. Power works. When it's mobilized at the top or it's mobilized at the bottom, it works. But it has to work in a way that gets beyond believing that all we have to do is vote. This is not just about voting. They don't care about your votes. They try to suppress voting. This is about the strategic use of the power of labor. People who work in everyday lives, who can go in front of a building, who can occupy a bank, who can walk into a corporate site, who can prevent Tesla from selling cars. It's not a call for violence. It's a call for nonviolence in the spirit of justice. And it has to take on a turn that it seems to me is concrete, is energizing, and is enormously educational about its own power.
Let me add another wrinkle to this discussion, because I totally agree with you. But I wondered what you thought about the fact that when Trump first took office, one of the first things he did was he purged the military. He got rid of people who were loyal to the Constitution and put in people that were loyal to him. What does this portend?
Well, I think if you really want to talk about that, connect it to his notion that he wants to spend $90 million to have a military parade in his honor. This is militarism on steroids. It's authoritarianism without a smile, but a smirk. It's a direct way of saying that if I have to use the military, the people will be in place for me to use it, and I will have no trouble whatsoever using the military on protests, on resistors, or on anybody else who attempts to get in the way. This is a threat of the highest order, and it's far more than symbolic. It's frightening. I mean, to be able to suggest that he will use the military to enforce what I call, and we don't use this term enough, and I hope I'm not going over the top for you, but understand something. We're in a period of domestic terrorism. That domestic terrorism is not being waged by lone wolves. It's being waged by the government. And now what he is trying to do is to make sure he has a military, and he has people in the military, in the leadership of the military, who will support him in the energizing and the implementation of domestic terrorism. Domestic terrorism is a war being waged by people in a country against their own people. That's what domestic terrorism is. And I think we need a new language to be able to understand how frightening all of this is.
We're sadly out of time, but how can people get in touch with you, follow your writings, follow your work, and to learn more about your thoughts on this critically important subject?
Well, I mean, there are really three ways to do this. One is I have a website, a homepage, where I post all my work. It's free. People can use it, read it, and hopefully learn something from it. And that's at www.henryagiroux.com. Or they can read Counterpunch. They can read Truth Out. They can read a number of outlets in which, fortunately, I have some very close friends who publish me. You won't find me in The Nation. You won't find me in The New York Times. You certainly won't find me in the Washington Post, but I think for those of us like yourself who are on the margins trying to spread the truth, if you look close enough, you'll find it. It's there.
You'll find Henry Giroux on Law and Disorder, folks, and Giroux is spelled G-I-R-O-U-X, Giroux. Henry, thank you so much for being on the show. We're truly grateful for your great work.
Listen, thank you so much for having me on. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, and I always feel honored.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
With respect to the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza, peace talks limp along. Israel has accelerated its war in Gaza and the West Bank. Recent remarks by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Donald Trump make it clear that both countries intend, if they can do it, to ethnically cleanse all of the Palestinian people from Palestine, bringing about the expected end result of their genocidal war on the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, here in the United States, President Trump has seized upon the claim of rampant anti-Semitism on our nation's college and university campuses to deport non-U.S. citizen leaders in the movement on the campuses in support of the Palestinian side in the war, and to withhold tens of millions of dollars from the campuses until they eliminate the quote-unquote anti-Semitic atmosphere on their campuses. And according to our guest today, press reporting in the mainstream media on the war has been less than clear and balanced as well. So today on Law and Disorder Radio, we've invited Norman Solomon to be our guest. Norman Solomon is the National Director of Roots Action and the Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. The paperback edition of his latest book, War Made Easy, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, includes an afterwards about the Gaza War. Norman Solomon, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks very much.
Norman, let's first take up the matter of the corporate media's coverage of the Israeli-U.S. war against Gaza and also the situation in the West Bank. You've been very critical of mainstream press coverage all over the war. Three questions. First, hasn't the way Israel has restricted reporters from covering the war been one big reason for your judgment about the press coverage of the war? And secondly, sadly, has not the fact that the coverage of the war on the ground has proven to be so dangerous, with so many members of the press being wounded and killed, caused the war coverage to be less than we might have wished for? And third, does your criticism of the way in which the war has been covered apply to how the media in America has covered the war? And if so, what has been wrong with the coverage here in the USA?
Well, really, the problems with restrictions on the journalists in Gaza are a subset of the overall dominance of the U.S. government sensibility over the way that media in the United States convey the news or don't convey the news to the people of the United States. When you first look at the restrictions, they've been extraordinary in terms of Israel clamping down on and preventing independent journalism to even provide any picture, really, of what's going on in Gaza. I mean, to a large extent, people in the United States are still largely clueless about the extent of the ethnic cleansing, their cruelty, the viciousness, and truly, as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have documented, the genocide going on, provided by Israel, made possible by the United States, both diplomatically around the world in terms of lack of pressure, and most importantly, with the weapons. So when you look at what's been going on with this Israeli war on and in Gaza for the last 18 months, the fact is that Israel hasn't allowed outside journalists into Gaza to independently cover what the hell's going on. So you'll see occasionally a major network escorted into Gaza by the misnamed Orwellian named Israeli Defense Force. And it's a guided tour. It's like a PR tour that the Israeli government is providing through its military escort to the U.S. media. But that doesn't even happen very often because non-Palestinian journalists are excluded from being allowed into Gaza by the Israeli military. So what are the implications of that? Those restrictions really mean that the only journalists covering what's going on inside Gaza, what is being done to Palestinians inside Gaza, are Palestinian journalists themselves. And so that's the only firsthand account we're getting, to the extent that the Palestinian journalism product, so to speak, is getting through to the people of the United States, with which, unlike independent media outlets such as this program or Democracy Now! And so forth, really does not reach the bulk of the people of the U.S. And that gets to another terrible reality, which is that since the only journalists providing coverage through media about what's going on in Gaza are Palestinian, then we look at what has been done to those journalists. And the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists has documented that in the last 18 months, more than 170 journalists have been killed in Gaza by the Israeli military. So this is literally, quite literally, the Israeli government killing the messengers because they're providing the bad news of genocide. And this very mainstream group, Committee to Protect Journalists, has shown that those 170, I will call them calibrated, targeted murders, for the most part, of Palestinian journalists, murders by the Israeli government in Gaza, that's the largest number of deaths of journalists in any conflict since the time that the organization began to gather the data in 1992. So this is really extraordinary, affects the kind of coverage we get and don't get. And in this case, it's really a combined effort by the U.S. and Israeli governments. The providing of arms, the waging of siege of Gaza, and the restrictions on how journalists can report on that terrible conflict.
Norman, let me be clear about this. Are you saying that the Israelis purposely zero in, identify and zero in, and assassinate reporters?
That's been very clearly the case even before the Gaza war began. The Committee to Protect Journalists has documented cases where journalists who were wearing vests with huge big letters, capital letters, press on them, have been intentionally targeted by the Israeli military. And in the last year and a half, that's become constant. It's become frequent. It's an effort by the Israeli government to snuff out, so to speak, the voices of journalists who are on the ground, these heroic Palestinian journalists, to snuff out their voices and to, in a sense, blinker the eyes or cover the eyes of the world as much as the Israelis can accomplish it, so that we are unable to see the full horrific reality of what the U.S.-backed war on Gaza is actually doing to human beings.
Are you equally critical of the coverage by the public radio as you are about the mainstream corporate media?
Unfortunately, National Public Radio, with its flagship programs, All Things Considered and Morning Edition, and the PBS NewsHour, have been only a bit better than U.S. mainstream avowedly corporate media. And I say avowedly because a lot of the funding going to NPR News and PBS News operations, a lot of the funding is coming directly from corporations. They call it underwriting credits, but they're really advertisements and commercials that you get on those programs, giving credit to the millions of dollars flowing from corporate entities into making these programs possible, or at least making them fully funded. I would say that NPR News and PBS NewsHour, while doing a bit better than the overall mainstream media of the United States, have still largely presented this war on Gaza through the eyes of the Israeli government and the top war-making, war-supporting officials in Washington. And this is nothing new. I mean, the Media Watch Group FAIR has been documenting for more than three decades how one war after another, mostly directly engaged in by the U.S. government through the Pentagon huge firepower, one war after another has been camouflaged, has been subjected to cosmetics, has not been reported on anywhere near adequately by the mainstream U.S. media, including NPR and PBS. You could say that, unfortunately, as is the case overall with mass media in the United States, with some blessed exceptions, so-called public broadcasting doesn't give the public a open window on the world in terms of, especially in terms of the impacts of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. militarism that now has 750 bases, military bases overseas. Really, it's a window on the world that is tinted red, white, and blue. And we are rarely reminded of the fact that the United States has 4% of the world's population, and yet conflicts overseas, whether they're military or political or economic, the default position from mass media, again, including so-called public broadcasting, is that our 4% of people on the planet are who really matter, and the other, 95% of the planet is secondary. So it's seeing the world through the eyes of Uncle Sam, so to speak, and that's tremendously distorting. And I wrote in my book, War Made Invisible, about how the discounting of the human lives affected by the U.S. war has been tremendously impactful in terms of the politics and political culture of the United States. So there's an implicit message that some lives really matter and some lives really don't. When an American dies in combat, or the population of a country where the government is aligned with the United States, when those people suffer from war, their suffering is amplified. It's greatly emphasized. The empathy is there. And I think the victims of war should be subjected to tremendous empathy. There should be very human coverage of what war really is. The problem comes when Pentagon firepower is inflicting the damage, terrorizing people, maiming, killing, causing long-term social, economic, and emotional damage, causing stress that is horrific in terms of individual lives, PTSD and so forth. Americans aren't the only ones who suffer from PTSD. When the U.S. Continues to bomb various countries, has been the case in the Middle East, for instance, very recently, ongoing in Yemen or Lebanon, that result is inclusive that people are being terrorized with those effects. As a matter of fact, last fall, when Israel set off many hundreds and hundreds into the thousands of pagers, right simultaneously, pagers and so forth, electronic devices, and maimed and blinded and injured literally thousands of people in Lebanon, the U.S. media overwhelming response from commentators and journalists was to use words like ingenious and innovative to describe what Israel had done in attacking people with these simultaneous explosions of electronic devices, including when children would pick them up, when they would rattle or sound an alarm that there was a page coming in. That was hailed as some kind of great technological, geopolitical, military innovation, hailed by U.S. media very, very widely. And yet, at the same time, Leon Panetta, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, said in an interview that there was no doubt in his mind that with those pager explosions, Israel was engaged in, quote, terrorism. That was former Secretary Panetta's word. Terrorism. So here you have an organization, the Israeli government, engaging in large-scale terrorism, and largely the U.S. media praised it, as did the Biden administration. That really is an example of how we have huge double standards that are operative, that are routine, and also it involves what I describe in the War Made Invisible book as two tiers of grief, two levels of grief that U.S. media and also people in Congress and the White House implicitly or explicitly propagate. And that is to say that when some people are blown apart by bombs, that's terrible and we should be empathetic. And of course we should be. But when other people are blown apart by bombs provided by or launched by the United States, it's implicitly supposed to be no big deal. And that is a moral, ethical, political, psychological corruption that is central to the militarism that pervades U.S. society.
Let me ask you about what's going on campuses. Campuses around the country have seen a almost universal severe crackdown on protests on their campuses. Students have been suspended on campuses. Some of them have even been picked up with the collaboration of universities and deported. And now the Trump administration is coming down hard on those same schools who Trump claims have not been doing enough to combat what they call anti-Semitism. And they've gone so far as to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars in federal research money from the supposedly offending colleges and universities. In fact, do you believe that the protests have been overrun with anti-Semitic speech? And do you think that Jewish students have been subjected to an unduly hostile climate on their campuses? Talk to us about this, please.
In terms of the protests against the Israeli war in Gaza and the U.S. government support for that war, there's been some anti-Semitism, overall very little. It's been vastly exaggerated by the U.S. government, by some Israel right-or-wrong right-wing groups, and they have their own agenda. They want to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, which is absurd. When we have groups, as I mentioned, like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, absolutely unequivocally declaring in their report last year, both of those groups, that Israel is engaged in genocide, how can it be that when students and professors on campus say that Israel is engaging in genocide, they're accused, often automatically, of being anti-Semitic? And this is basically a cudgel, a weaponized political tool to try to suppress the very, not only valid, but essential criticism and opposition toward what Israel is doing in Gaza and what the U.S. government is doing to help them do it. These are massive crimes against humanity. And the idea that opposing those crimes is anti-Semitic is not only absurd, but extremely dangerous.
So do you think that we're in an era of new McCarthyism, or are we deeply in it or just getting into it?
It's a form of McCarthyism. I think we are looking now at a pattern of McCarthyite repression that is extreme on many campuses. The trustees, many of the very big donors, the presidents and deans of these colleges that are basically subservient to the trustees and so forth, they've been buckling. They've been buckling under pressure. They've been displaying, with a few blessed exceptions, tremendous cowardice. And we're not talking about small, underfunded colleges necessarily. We're talking about places like Columbia and Harvard with multi-billions of dollars in assets. And they don't want to give any of their establishment clout out. They don't want to forfeit any of their modicums of supposed respectability by actually fighting back for academic freedom. And when you hear the platitudes from universities about how they support academic freedom, and then you see how they are absolutely collapsing and forfeiting the most basic, voluntarily giving up the most fundamental principles of academic freedom, it's really an eye-opener to how subservient the academic establishment overall has been to the military-industrial complex. You know, this is not an old critique. President Dwight Eisenhower, when he was leaving office in his farewell address, warned against what he called the dangers of, and I'm quoting here, the military-industrial complex. Now we could extend that. It's been much worse in the last couple of decades, certainly than it was in 1961. And we could say, yes, it is a very powerful military-industrial complex. It's also, or could be described as, a military-industrial media technological academic complex. It's a pattern of suppression that demands conformity, that insists that we should not make any fundamental critiques of the corporate military power that has largely shaped U.S. foreign policy and distorted our own economy. You know, you go around the United States to any state, to virtually any community, and you will find so many people who are lacking in healthcare, education, housing, infant care, elderly care, and you look at the military budget, and it's huge. It's now about 55% of the discretionary budget of the United States. Martin Luther King Jr. warned about this. He talked about what he described as, and I'm quoting here, the destructive demonic suction tube of sending vast quantities of funds to the Pentagon to fight wars and prepare for wars, while people here at home, let alone elsewhere in the world, are suffering from lack of basic resources. These are moral questions. These are matters of moral politics, which really, when you come down to it, is what people are compelled to engage in politics about. There are the power trippers and those who work very hard for their personal aggrandizement of wealth and power. But for a lot of people, one way or another, whatever we might think about their particular political outlooks, they see themselves as wanting to engage in a kind of a moral activity. They feel that politics should somehow be responsive to and be an incarnation of some kind of moral precepts, the Northern Star that you would follow. And people may largely or often disagree about what that should entail in terms of policy. But I think what we're seeing now is the collapse of much of the liberal establishment to immoral policies that have been pursued and now are being successfully pursued increasingly by the right wing of the United States, the Trump administration, the Republicans in Congress, and so forth. And so they are winning the race to the bottom of U.S. militarism, and we're seeing the horrific results at home and abroad.
Now let's talk about what Netanyahu and Trump want to see happen in Gaza. Netanyahu just visited the White House, and it seems like both Trump and Netanyahu want to see the complete either murder or removal of all the Palestinians in Gaza, either kill them, bomb them, or get them out of there. Do you think that's what's going to happen?
I don't have a crystal ball, but I would say that soon after the war on Gaza began, there were a lot of questions in the U.S. media. What is the end game of the Israeli government? And I think it's been fairly transparent that the end game is to kill a lot of Palestinian people, not only with bombs and bullets, but with the siege that has choked off access to medicine and food and water even. And that has involved basically using starvation as a weapon of war. So part of it is literally extermination of a lot of Palestinian civilians, and also to create such suffering and desperation that they will one way or another be moved out or leave Gaza to go into Egypt or Lebanon or wherever. So I think that is a goal. And frankly, when you look at the history of Israel from its founding in 1948, the first Nakba, the moving, removal, and killing of so many Palestinians whose ancestors had been living in the same communities, the same villages and areas for hundreds and hundreds of years. Zionism as a word means many different things to many people, but the core message that Jews from around the world should come to Israel and implicitly drive out Palestinian people, that is an ethnic cleansing project. It absolutely is about committing the crime of ethnic cleansing on a large scale. And I think Americans should remember that in 1999, when the United States led the UN, the U.S., I should say, the NATO bombing, when the United States led the NATO bombing of Kosovo and Yugoslavia, President Clinton at the time made more than one speech saying that ethnic cleansing is absolutely intolerable, and we should not, as Americans, tolerate it around the world, and we should step in to prevent it from happening. And yet, the United States in 2025 is not only allowing ethnic cleansing to happen in Gaza and in the West Bank, the United States is literally making it possible.
Norman, we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, I'm Jewish, you're Jewish, our families are facing the question of Passover, which is on April 11th. This show will be broadcast a few days after April 11th, but nonetheless, we're both faced with the possibility of going to Passover services. And I remember when I used to go with Michael Ratner, he would say, you know, as a matter of archaeological fact, there is no evidence that the Jews were taken to Egypt and then got out of Egypt and left and were free. There's no archaeological evidence for that. Nevertheless, Passover is a holiday where freedom is celebrated. And I find that quite, given what's going on in Gaza, quite a difficult concept now. If you were to go to a Passover service and conduct it, what message would you give?
I would give the message of let my people go in 2025. And my people is humanity. My people includes Palestinian people. And it's necessary for us to demand and fight for in every nonviolent way we can the change in U.S. policy as Americans to insist that we must do everything we can to let my people go, because my people is human beings around the planet. And in this case, since the United States gives such vast quantities of weapons and other kinds of military aid to Israel, it's just imperative that whatever our religion or faith or lack of faith in the United States, as Americans, we insist that our government stop inflicting genocide on people in Gaza, in the West Bank, and really stand for human rights at last.
Norman Solomon, I want to ask you how people can stay in touch with you and your writings, and I also want you to talk about your book, which we've already discussed on the show, but I think it's so relevant today. It's called War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. So could you briefly mention your book, tell people how they can get it, and then tell people, our audience, how they can be in touch with you as your work comes out?
Well, thanks very much. And I want to say, before I forget, the National Lawyers Guild has been so crucial in defending the constitutional and human rights of people for many decades. And as the saying goes, now more than ever, we need that kind of courage coming from legal activists and others, given what's coming up this very perilous time in the United States. When I was working on the paperback edition of War Made Invisible that came out last fall, I kept looking at the subtitle that you mentioned, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And because I was writing an afterword about the Gaza War, I kept focusing on the words military machine. How about the U.S. military machine, and what does it have to do with the Israel Defense Forces, as it's known? And it really dawned on me that the Israeli military is part of the American military machine. They have a different command structure. They might have some disagreements at times, but their geopolitical goals, their strategies, and often their intelligence sharing, their research, their weaponry development, it's all intertwined. They're part of the same machine. So the War Made Invisible book, particularly the paperback edition, really deals with the continuity between U.S. warfare for many, many decades, from Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan, and de facto, indirectly, in Gaza. It's all tied in with a worldview and a foreign policy of the United States that is so damaging and cruel, really, to so many people around the world. And so that's, you know, why I was very pleased that I could write the War Made Invisible book and share it with other people. I'm a writer and also an activist, and I'm very glad to be part of the Roots Action organization. And by the way, people can sign up for our action alerts at rootsaction.org. We have more than a million people who are now getting those action alerts. And one of our projects that I do want to mention that's very relevant to the discussion we've been having is that Roots Action has launched something called Teach-In Network. And we have encouraged and supported teach-ins around the country, virtual online as well as on the ground, college campuses and off-college campuses, to fight back against the repression, to fight back against the abrogation and suppression of First Amendment rights. And we offer a lot of experts who can, without charge, speak to people in their organizations or on their Zoom calls or whatever. So I want to invite people to visit that site and avail yourself of what we have to offer. It's simply online at teachinnetwork.org. That's teachinnetwork.org. And as always, even as dire as the news is, we need to create some better news, and that means organizing with like-minded people and getting things done.
Well, Norman Solomon, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. I hope that people will tune in to the Roots Action and get active as well. And I certainly appreciate your interview today. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.